8 in Tampa Bay tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, November 22nd. Sunny and cold. Today's high 36. Tonight 28. Thanksgiving Day looks okay. Partly sunny for the morning, then sunny for the afternoon. Tomorrow's high 43. Right now sunny. 20 degrees Racine, 19 Kenosha. Wind chill is 13. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are talking about home on this portion of WGTD's morning show. And as it says in the book we're going to be talking about, home is a loaded word, a complex idea. There are so many ways to define it. The book at hand is called This Is the Place, Women Writing About Home. And the really thoughtful writing of a number of talented female writers, 30 in all, reflect on various notions of home, what home can mean at its worst, what home sometimes means at its worst. Home is a place of safety. Home sometimes is a place of great pain. And sometimes home can be all kinds of different things. It's not just that some people have happy homes, some people have sad homes, but for most of us, home is a indeed complicated place that can represent all kinds of things, the brightest and the darkest aspects of our lives. And certainly as one reads this wonderful book, one gets a very powerful sense of that reality, of what it means to be home. The book has two different editors, and I'm very pleased to be speaking with one of them, Margot Kahn, the author of Horses That Buck. Her work has appeared in a number of different places. And this particular book, This Is the Place, Women Writing About Home, is published by Seal Press. Margot Kahn, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love the book. I really, really did. What a great idea. Whose idea was it? Where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea came to me a number of years ago. It was before I had a child of my own. I've been thinking about home probably my whole life, really, like many of us. But when I was very young, my grandparents, I spent a lot of time at my grandparents' house growing up, and my grandparents had come to this country from Europe in the late 1930s, early 1940s, and they had left their home country of Poland against their will. They used to tell me stories about where they grew up, and their stories about home were at once nostalgic and warm and wonderful, and also at the same time extremely painful. And they never went back to their home country, and I always wondered what that must have been like for them. I was always trying to understand what that might feel like. Many years later, when
go ahead.
Many years later, you know, as just a woman of my generation going off to school, you know, after I left my parents' house, I moved around quite a bit, And so I thought about home then, too, in a different way, you know, renting apartments, living with other people. And then eventually I chose a city to live in that I fell in love with the city and the landscape. And then I fell in love with another person who also loved that place. And we settled and we bought a home and we had a child. But it and we became very much a part of a community. But it wasn't the place that I grew up. And so it was, you know, much later that I started to think about, oh, well, this is my home, but it's not the home that I grew up in. My family is not, you know, my parents aren't here. And so a sort of a new layer of home started to form for me, this home that I was creating kind of on my own. And then, of course, having a child took all those things up a notch. You know, what was this place I was creating, not just for myself and my partner, but for my offspring, you know, another human being.
So tell us about the process of gathering together the thoughts of all of these different women on the concept of home. Who are these women? Are they all women that you already knew? Or otherwise, what was your connection to them? And just tell us about the experience of gathering them together and, in a sense, galvanizing them to be part of this intriguing project.
Sure. A lot of these women I knew of. A small handful of them I knew personally, but many others I knew of their work. Many others were people who were sort of second-degree connections. Kelly McMasters, my co-editor, and I reached out to certain people who already seemed to be writing on or around this theme of home, and some were able to accept right away and were very excited, and others who loved the topic but were under deadline or had other things going on recommended to us other people who they thought would be great additions. So our network sort of creeped out that way. We also put out open calls to a number of different organizations, Cave Canem, Lambda Literary, our graduate school networks. So we had, you know, truly an open call with an email address where anyone could submit an essay. And we did take a couple of essays from there, from people we had never heard of. So, you know, as we gathered all these essays together, it was a fascinating process of seeing what people brought to the table with only the direction of please write on the theme of home. We didn't give any other direction beyond that. And we wanted to gather as sort of broad a range of voices as we could. So we were very conscious of gathering voices of different ages, different ethnicities, different races, different geographic locations, and just different backgrounds of all kinds. But as we did that, we saw that as different as the stories were, there were so many commonalities. And it really was the word you used, galvanizing, was such a natural word. All these stories really have come together in such a beautiful and surprising conversation. And I think that's the way I like to think about this book, is that it's such a diverse collection of voices that it's, I think, next to each other, each of these pieces is just a magnificent conversation about what this idea of home means.
Mm-hmm. I quite agree. The book is This Is the Place. We're speaking with one of its editors, Margot Kahn. Margot Kahn, I hope you won't mind terribly if I make brief mention of another book that I explored for this program some years ago that at least in its outer framework is a little bit reminiscent of it, a collection of writings by various women about the experience of having a nanny, a book actually called Searching for Mary Poppins. And again, a very interesting gathering of diverse voices, or at least somewhat diverse voices, although this book represents an even wider diversity of experience than that one did. I'm thinking of that book and thinking of one of the questions I asked one of its editors, which was, what about men? I remember phrasing it as, I'm a man, I love this book, I think this book is wonderful. Once in a while, I felt this strange little pang of wait a minute, men live in homes too, men make homes too. Why do we not have any voices of men here? Did this need to be a book about women? And I didn't mean the question to sound cranky. I don't mean it to sound cranky now. But I'm just curious what you think is important about this being a collection of writings by only women.
Absolutely. That is a question that Kelly and I grappled with for some time. Because men do have a place in the home, and more we see more men taking more of a role in the domestic sphere. And, you know, in this push towards equality and progress, that is something that we are very happy to see. And so Kelly and I did grapple with this idea of, you know, are we perpetuating a sort of marginalizing stereotype that home is a woman's place by only including women's voices? And did leaving men out somehow suggest that their role in creating a home is less important? Have we done a disservice to gender stereotypes in general? Or are we rewriting or recreating this narrative? I think the fact of the matter is that traditionally, historically, home has been the woman's place. And even as modern women, you know, we were predominantly raised by our mothers and our grandmothers. It's something that is very much on our minds as modern women, what our role at home will be and how we are balancing home and work and mothering, if that's a choice. So, you know, when it comes down to it, we felt like it is important for women's voices to really have a place. And the fact of the matter is also that women's voices are still underrepresented in many arenas, publishing included. So, you know, we felt like these voices really needed to be heard, and they needed to be heard together. And we also chose a press that has been championing and publishing women's voices since 1976. So we felt, you know, ultimately we feel really good about the fact that this is a collection of women and voices that really need to be heard.
Right. And just to be clear, I feel good about that choice as well, very much, especially after reading the book. Some of what you were just talking about reminds me of some of what you say in your own essay, that is one of the 30, titled In the Kitchen, when you say at one point, the title homemaker is not something I will put on my resume. And yet you go on to say that you have come to realize just how satisfying homemaking, in sort of the purest sense of the word, can be. Say a word about how you have come to, in a sense, understand both the word and that role differently through the course of your own life.
Sure. Like I said, I spent a lot of time at my grandparents' house growing up, and as I discuss in my essay, my grandmother was really a formative person in my life, and she was primarily a homemaker. She actually, I don't discuss this in the essay, but she actually did work for a time selling cosmetics in a department store in downtown Cleveland, and she really enjoyed that role. She was from Poland, but people in Cleveland couldn't really place her accent, so they often thought she was French and had a certain cachet, and she sold a lot of cosmetics. And so she had a great confidence about her work, but ultimately my grandfather didn't want her to work. And he had his own small business selling umbrellas, and he sort of needed her help and wanted her to be at home doing the home things. So I was very influenced by her. But I didn't realize quite how much until I had a child of my own, and then really kind of came to this internal struggle of, do I want to be home raising my child, or do I want to be at work, or how do I do both of those things together? And like you noticed, you know, I have come to realize that while I both very much enjoy my work, I also find being at home a very important and stabilizing thing for my family and for myself. And I do believe that it's an important role that is not given enough credit, usually. And it pains me when I hear people say about women who are staying home to raise their children that, you know, they're taking a break or they're wasting their talents or they're not doing anything because women are doing a lot at home. And I am also, you know, watching very closely, and I'm proud to be living in a state that is looking closely at family leave policies that recognize that the work of staying home is indeed work, and that it is not only women's work. That, you know, Washington State in particular is putting into place family leave policies for women and men, following in the footsteps of some other countries who have found that this is a really equalizing move to make. And I'm really pleased to see that. I think that that is a great step in the right direction.
Absolutely. I want to touch on a few of the essays in the book that I found especially striking. And I think just by highlighting several of them, I think our listeners will get a very good idea of just how wide a swath is covered by this book, which on the other hand still has a wonderful cohesiveness to it somehow, even though we are hearing so many different stories from so many different perspectives. I appreciated very much the essay by a woman named Desiree Cooper, who, among other things, talked about the experience of moving during her childhood very, very frequently, and how for her and her family, moving was always a little bit tinged with sadness, but also represented a time for reinvention, a time to reset our lives. I'm so glad that that's there, because I think when one thinks about a book with a bunch of essays about home, that's the kind of experience that so directly touches on home for lots and lots of people. And yet a lot of times when we think about home, we don't think about it in those kind of terms as one home and then another home and another home and another home and another home for those families where, for one reason or another, that is the reality with which they're living.
Exactly. I'm glad you brought that essay up. It's a beautiful, beautiful one. And in Desiree's case, you know, she was part of a military family, and she moved not only within the United States, but abroad as well. And I love how she talks about what it is that ultimately matters when you move that much, because so often we think of home as a stationary place, or, you know, even if we move a lot, there's one place in particular that stands out. But for her, in all the places that she moves to, there are certain objects that the family takes with them, and there are certain ways that the family bonds together from place to place to place that keeps this cohesive idea of home in a different way.
I also appreciate that essay ends with her talking about the very sad reality of the dementia experienced, especially by her mother, and the idea that dementia, when it comes in the way that it is with her mother, can rob someone of that precious sense of being safe within the familiarity of one's home. In the case of her mother, she no longer views her home like that. It's no longer home to her. It's a strange place, and in her mind, home is someplace else. A home is someplace else she longs to be. And thinking about the plight of someone like that really gets us thinking about how wonderful it is when we can have that sense of home, in a sense, undisturbed.
Yes, exactly.
I want to give you a chance to talk about another intriguing essay called Broken Home by Deborah Gwartney. And this is a case in which we are not talking about home in the sunniest, rosiest of conditions, but a situation in which home and the sense of being safe at home is almost savagely disturbed. Explain to our listeners the heart and soul of this essay.
So in this piece, the writer, Deborah, goes through a divorce, and she has four small children, and she is able to find a place to be. She very much wants her children to have a stable place that they can call home, where they feel safe and where they can be a family. She finds a house. It's very run down. It needs a bunch of work, and they move into this house, and everything seems to be going well. And without giving too much away, there is a breach of that safety that is really devastating for Deborah and her girls. And she grapples very deeply with this idea that she was doing the very best that she could. And yet, on occasion, things happen that, like you said, you know, the safety of a place that we are creating can be breached, can be broken. And what do we do with that loss of safety? She talks a bit about what happens in the aftermath and how her daughters all sort of scatter because after this incident, the home is no longer the place that they thought it was, and they are all going to have to deal with that in their own ways.
There is another intriguing essay called On Moving Home, in which the writer, Kirsten Lundstrom, talks about the experience of moving back with her parents or her in-laws. Now, I can't remember which, but this is also a phenomenon that that occurs from time to time, and can be replete with all kinds of challenges. And I really appreciate the inclusion of this essay because for her, it was an opportunity, really, to sort of rethink what it means to be home and what is most important in terms of having that sense of home.
Yes, this essay was actually one of the first essays that I thought of when I thought about doing this collection. I had heard Kirsten talk about this experience, and I loved the way she thought about this time of intergenerational living that she had with her family. She was living in New York with her husband and two young children, and she had a wonderful job. Her husband had a wonderful job, but they both felt, especially her, that something was deeply lacking. She very, very much missed home in that true sense when we say we are homesick. She really was homesick for a landscape and a closeness with her family members who were all the way across the country in the Pacific Northwest. And she and her husband finally decided that it was time for them to leave New York. She really couldn't be so far away anymore. And they decided to move back to the Pacific Northwest, but the only way that they could do it financially was to move back in with her parents. And as she says in her essay, this is something that, you know, nowadays a lot of young people do, but there is still oftentimes a stigma attached to it. Like you're somehow a failure if you are supposed to be launching on your own and yet you're moving back into your parents' house. And yet she finds through the process that it's this really incredibly beautiful thing living with her parents again as an adult and seeing them in a new light and having a new relationship with them. And also, it's this beautiful experience for her children to be so close to their grandparents and for the grandparents to have this daily interaction, to take the children to school, to go swimming with them and play, and also to see them in their low moments, the moments where the children have to go to time out or where they're behaving badly at the table. The family really comes together in a very new and beautiful way.
Right.
And
in sort of contrast to what we think of as, I mean, this isn't certainly always the way it happens, but quite often when one visits one's grandparents, you are on the best of behavior, and it's another thing when you are living with them day in and day out for quite some period of time, and really, in a sense, seeing each other in more unvarnished fashion. And and she writes there also, of course, about she seeing her own parents as adults in a way that she never had before—a really revelatory experience. There is another essay by Kaylee Wallen called Sea Home that, as I started reading it, I thought, oh, I don't know that I need to read this. And I actually ended up loving this essay, which is about how for her and her husband, 6 months of a year, they are living on a boat and what it's like when a boat is one's home. And she has something very special and refreshing to share here.
Yes, I love this piece too. And this was one of the pieces that came to us unsolicited. I love how she describes her life on this very small boat, and not just with her partner, but with a baby as well. The sacrifices that they have made to make this lifestyle work for them. And I love this connection she draws with the whales at the end. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but, you know, this idea that a kind of migratory existence is actually a very natural thing for a lot of creatures on Earth, and the way that they split their time between Mexico and the cold Pacific Northwest or Alaska, where they can find work, is really mimicking exactly the pattern of some natural creatures in the world.
Hmm. There is also an essay by Danny Shapiro in which the heart and soul of the matter is kind of the trauma of leaving their young baby with a babysitter or nanny for the first time. It's the first time, basically, that both she and her husband are away from the home at the same time. And we don't want to give too much away, but let's just say that something bad, something really quite terrifying, happens within minutes. I only mention that essay because I think it's really, it underscores the fact that when we talk about home, we are talking about all kinds of other things besides the home itself, that the concept of home touches on so many facets of our lives, including the life we have outside the home, whatever that life is, and the experience of sometimes leaving home behind, who lives there, who we care about, what we try to protect them from. Going into this, did you have a full appreciation of just how many things would ultimately be talked about and explored in such a collection about home?
You know, I thought I did, but ultimately I was surprised. I know, when I thought about this collection initially, I thought about neighbors. I thought about the music we listen to, the things we collect. I thought about moving in and out of different places and making decisions about where to settle down. I thought about families and growing older and moving out of homes we've lived in for many, many years. And I thought about homelessness, which is a huge issue in the city that I live in, gentrification, which is happening all around, again, in the city I live in and in many other places. There are so many aspects, both politically and personally, to this theme. I think what is very interesting that Kelly and I did not realize, because we started this project many years ago, is what would happen with our political situation and so many issues that are arising today with immigration, with the end of DACA, are bringing up these questions of home. You know, whose place is this? Who belongs here? Who is welcome here? Who is made to feel safe here? And when we solicited these essays, we were sort of in a different time. And they seem, each of them in their own way, seems even more important now to reflect on and to think about.
The book, again, is This Is the Place, Women Writing About Home, published by Seal, edited by Kelly McMasters and my morning show guest, Margot Kahn. Margot Kahn, thank you so much for helping to put together this remarkable book. I am so glad we got to talk about it today. Best wishes.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. And to finish out today's morning show, we have some thoughts on fathers, fathering, and fatherhood from Dan Gettleman, very well known to public radio listeners, who, among other things, was responsible for reviving a radio program that had first been heard in the early 1950s on CBS, This I Believe, created by Edward R. Murrow. Dan Gettleman brought back This I Believe, and it still exists as a very popular podcast, and it has spawned a number of different books, including the one at hand, This I Believe on Fatherhood, a lovely collection of remarkable essays talking about fathers, fatherhood, and even a few that talk about fathering when it does not occur with the actual father, but somebody who fulfills that very important role in a child's life. This collection of essays includes a really beautiful essay by a writer from Wisconsin.
His name is Eric Larson. He's from Waukesha. Did I pronounce that right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. From Waukesha, and he writes a wonderful essay. It's called The Cards Will Hear You. The cards meaning playing cards, and it's really a perfect example of an essay from this book, in that it focuses both on what he learned from his father in playing cards, and sort of the card playing as a metaphor for life, that you should be a good sport, you should lose well, you should win well. You should enjoy it while you're doing it, and not just focus on the outcome of the hand or the game or the match or whatever. And then he's taken this as both kind of a life philosophy that he's put into use throughout his life, but also very specifically as a parenting philosophy, to try to instill that same concept into his children, so that they're not so focused on the end result of whatever it is they're doing, and sort of enjoy the ride, regardless of the outcome.
I wonder if you happen to remember what's my favorite moment in that essay, which is really about tackling life with a positive spirit. And, of course, we've heard that a lot. I mean, sometimes it's one of the last things we feel like hearing about again, yet again.
Right.
But boy, when somebody puts it as well as Mr. Larson does, it's worth reading. My favorite part of that essay is when he talks about visiting his 89-year-old great-great-uncle.
Yes.
Do you remember this exchange?
Yeah, his great-great-uncle is in the hospital recovering from a stroke, and he gives him this you know, vice grip handshake, and says, "Hey, not too bad for an old man," you know, just sort of the antithesis of what you expect a frail elderly person who's probably in their last few months to do. It's a wonderful moment.
Yeah, he finishes that talking about that by saying he would not be defeated by a stroke or old age.
That's
this
right.
was no deathbed.
That's exactly right.
We're speaking with Dan Gediman. We are talking about the most recent book to be published out of the essay series This I Believe, this book called This I Believe on Fatherhood. Mr. Gediman, before we talk about a couple other really notable essays in this wonderful book, I wonder if you could just say a word in general about how, and maybe the answer is you don't particularly know the answer to this question, but I am very curious to know, if you know, how these essays typically take shape. I mean, in many cases, we're talking about people who do not write for a living and maybe are trying to do this for the first time in their lives. And, of course, in other cases, we are talking about people who are skilled writers and experienced writers, but nevertheless, it's a very personal sort of expression. But do you ever get any kind of notion of under what circumstances or over what sort of timeline these essays tend to sort of take shape?
Sure. You know, it's funny. As you called me for this interview, I was staring at a postcard that I have on my desk from John Updike, who wrote an essay for us back in 2005. And Updike told us that it was the most difficult writing exercise or writing assignment he'd ever been given, in that it's, on the one hand, open-ended, right? He's not writing about a particular topic that someone tells him to write about, but he has a very limited space to write it, 500 words. And so he had a very difficult time doing it, and as a matter of fact, he really didn't follow the directions. You're supposed to, the essence of what makes a This I Believe essay is that it is written from the first-person perspective. It's not proscriptive. Here's what you ought to think. This is, or you ought to believe. It's what I believe. That it focuses on a single belief, and that it tells the story behind that belief. Where did it come from? Who inspired it, or what experience inspired it? Did you used to have a differing belief, and then it changed somehow because of some event? Or perhaps it was this a belief that you had, you know, sort of in theory earlier in life, and then you had some experience that galvanized it and really strengthened it. And so Mr. Updike kind of cheated and wrote his essay about three different things. So people tell us it's very difficult. There's another essayist in this book, in the This I Believe on Fatherhood book, who is a writer by trade and has written several novels, and he said that writing his This I Believe essay took him longer than all the other books he had written put together. It took him 18 months to write his essay. He kept writing new drafts, and he'd come up, you know, with a new idea, and then he'd start again. So some people find it really difficult. But then other people tell us, we've had several people with variations of the same story, which is that they heard one of our essay segments on public radio, and they had one of these, like, driveway moments, or in one case, a freeway moment, where essentially this guy was driving home from work, and he was, you know, inspired by what he heard on NPR, and he decided to write his own essay. So he did it on his, like, BlackBerry in between red lights. You know, whenever he got to a red light, he'd jot down some more notes, and then he'd drive a little bit and then get to his next red light and write some more. And so he composed his essay, or at least the first draft of his essay, with his thumbs on his BlackBerry in traffic.
One of the things I was struck by as I read through this intriguing book, and you touched on this matter in one of the first things you said in our interview, is the fact that when we are talking about fathers and fatherhood and how we are affected by our fathers, that sometimes that can be a very inspiring, gratifying, wonderful, life-affirming story. And that in other cases, fatherhood can be, sadly, about something else.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be among the harshest lessons that we are taught. I wonder if you could just speak a word about that reality.
Sure.
And how that influenced the shaping of this book and which essays you chose to share with the public in this fashion.
Sure. Well, you know, we gave this a lot of thought because, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there who have had very conflicted or challenging relationships with their fathers. And I dare say there are a lot of fathers out there who have had very conflicted relationships with their children. It's a relationship by its nature where there's a lot of expectations built into it on both sides, meaning, you know, kids expect their parents to be a certain way, to be invincible, to never make mistakes, to always be wise and, you know, never let them down, that sort of thing. And then on the other side, of course, you have parents who have very high expectations of their children, drive them hard or upset when they don't get A's on their report cards or, you know, don't win at whatever sports, you know, whatever sporting event they're participating in. So there's a lot of essays. I won't say a lot. There are a handful of essays in the book that look at that more those more challenging parts of the parenting relationship between fathers and children. There's one in particular in the book that we felt, you know, compelled to include because it again is a very real world experience, and that is where the father is an alcoholic or drug addict and was impaired as a father and not able to, you know, fully participate in the child's life and or was abusive or, you know, abandoned the family, whatnot. And it's a beautiful essay in the book from a man who writes about how he was just filled with vitriol toward his father throughout his childhood and adolescence and adulthood, because his father was an alcoholic and not a very reliable father, to say the least. And then he had his own child. And somehow he had this epiphany looking at his child in the crib and feeling this enormous outpouring of love for his child. And he thought, you know, as bad as my dad was, he must have gazed upon me in the way I'm gazing upon my child at some point. And he must have loved me and wanted to do a good job, and he just couldn't. He just was impaired. And so he somehow forgave his father just by the power of his love for his own child. And there were quite a few essays that we considered for the book that were variations on that theme of coming to terms with a difficult relationship with a father and coming to some sort of forgiveness or acceptance of, you know, when they weren't really there or didn't do a very good job.
Hmm. I am reminded of the essay written by Doug Andrews called The Best Legacy I Can Leave. That essay is about the sad reality that his father committed suicide and his father before him also committed suicide.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And Doug Andrews trying to come to terms with that reality and trying to sort out how he could chart a different course for himself that would not end up with that same tragic end.
Yeah, that's quite a powerful essay. And yeah, his greatest legacy that he can leave for his children, both his father and his grandfather killed themselves in the same way by asphyxiating themselves in the garage. And so his big thing is to just keep the garage door open, you know, and not let the darkness and challenges of life overwhelm him so that he will leave that legacy for his children. So, yes, there are echoes of that in several other essays, that notion that, you know, I'm going to break whatever that cycle is in my family, whether it's, you know, in this case, suicide or alcoholism or, there's a, you know, there are quite a few parents who have had to really explore, you know, things like corporal punishment. You know, well, you know, my father used to give me a licking and his father gave him a licking, and by God, I'm going to do the same thing for my kids. And then maybe you reconsider that, or maybe put it in a different context that, you know, there's basically, it seems like, two truisms about parenthood, and that is people do exactly what was done to them, or they do 180 degrees different what was done to them. You know, by God, I'm never going to do that to my kid. So it's very interesting to see the variations on those two philosophies borne out in these various essays, where, you know, especially if it was a very good relationship and there was great wisdom imparted, then you've got a blueprint for what to do yourself when the time comes to be a parent. And when it wasn't so good, you perhaps have a blueprint that you can sort of look at in reverse. Here are the things I won't do, or I would rather not do.
We're speaking with Dan Gettemann. We're talking about a marvelous collection of essays stemming from the series This I Believe, this book called This I Believe on Fatherhood. And I don't know if we've made this clear yet, but this is, I think we've at least said it once, that this is not a collection of essays written either by fathers or sons, but that this is a collection which includes the writing of daughters.
Absolutely.
And also certain essays which touch on even when fathering is not done by one's father in particular.
That's right.
In fact, one of my favorite essays in the book, maybe my favorite essay actually in some respects, is an essay about a situation where the father essentially made himself absent. Mm-hmm. And became completely absent, and this woman's three sons,
yes,
ended up being fathered by very important men in,
right,
their life. Michelle Weldon.
Michelle Weldon, yes. We actually had her. We did an event in Chicago with Bob Edwards, a live event with WBEZ, the public radio station there, not too far away from you.
Right.
Last year, and Michelle was one of the people who read her essay live at the event and had all of those men who had been her father, her children's father figures in the audience, along with her boys. It was very powerful. Yes, she talks about how each of her boys was in essence fathered by various people in their lives, sports coaches, uncles, friends of the family, all of whom had sort of risen to the occasion of providing what these boys needed in terms of male role models and guidance and, in some case, discipline, so that they could, you know, it's a truism that, you know, it's very helpful to have a parent of the same gender to bounce things off of and teach you how to do things and teach you how to not do things. And when you are a single parent and you are without that other parent to help guide those children in those ways, then you have to sort of improvise, you know. And much has been written about the negative effects of, you know, a generation or two of boys that have been raised without their fathers and how that, you know, can then perhaps lead them toward, you know, other kinds of associations, you know, most tragically perhaps street gangs, you know, where they can't get that sort of, you know, male energy that they might get from positive people in their lives, so they get it in some negative way. So, yes, she does a beautiful job of celebrating these men that were in her children's lives,
right,
or that are in her children's lives. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a perfect example of an essay in this book that sort of defies necessarily the stereotype of what you think of when you think of fathers.
Dan Gettemann, well-known public radio announcer, contributor, reporter, part of the This I Believe series, which is now a popular podcast, and the editor of this book called This I Believe on Fatherhood. I'm Gregory Berg. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, although not tomorrow and not Friday because of the Thanksgiving break. The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. You will find the Morning Show archive stretching back several years. If there are past morning shows that you have either missed or want to listen to again. And once again, the address of our website is simply WGTD.org.